Accession number 29075, Reel 7.
Graham Meredith, Reel 7. After your time with the First Sea Lord again, what came next?
Well, they first wanted me to go to Chatham to be the secretary to the Flag Officer of Medway. And this was a job I didn't really want to do, because it would get, once again, it was in the Ivory Tower. And I felt I wanted to get back into the real Navy. Well, one would be closer to it, of course, in Flag Officer Medway. But there were a fair number of domestic difficulties about doing that. So I said to my appointer, send me to sea, send me to a job where it's real Navy. Why not Faz Lane, for instance, I said. And blow me, that's what happened. I was the mutt they saw coming, but it was a wonderful job. And I went to HMS Neptune, up at Faz Lane, in the summer of 68, well, September 68, I suppose I started. 69, September 69. And I was the deputy base supply officer, which meant working under the base supply officer for the management of the supply department shore facilities, which were really pretty sophisticated there, and then, or sophisticated for those times. Then I was the squadron supply officer for the Polaris submarines, the 10th Submarine Squadron. I was the squadron supply officer for the 3rd Submarine Squadron, which had SSNs, the nuclear submarines, and some conventionals. I was in charge of the supply side of the working up of all submarines, because all submarines came up to the Clyde to do their workups. I also had responsibilities for the submarines that were in refit all over the country, and particularly for ships that were building. So it was really quite a large job, and I've often described it as being at least 4 separate jobs, and only one man had them. Hugely busy, great fun, a lot of sea riding. Baptism of fire on the Polaris side, because very shortly after I arrived, the Renown had a collision with a local coaster just outside the Clyde, and as a result, the captain was removed, and one or two other people in the ship, in the boat, were removed, and the new captain asked me and another chap, to help him in the ops room, to go with him on his first patrol. So we went off for about 8 days, and I had never been to sea in a Polaris submarine before. But what I very quickly had already begun to discover was that the submarine service was special, but it wasn't that much different, really, from things from general service. And there were various procedures that I had come across, learnt, for instance, in the air stores world, which I introduced into the submarine support world. I didn't say I'd won them from the air world, but and they went down a bundle. And I found that going to sea in the Renown, there were many similarities with every other sort of sea job I'd ever had before. And it was not a good thing, really, to try and be too different in the specialty of submarines. I mean, there are special, particularly operationally, you know, when you're dived and so on. But inside the boat, it's much the same as anything else. Anyway, I had a very, very busy time in that job, and survived in it for about 9 or 10 months. And then they promoted me to commander, or said that I was going to be promoted to commander, which actually rather disappointed me, because I had all sorts of things in hand which I was never then able to see through to completion. So I did another couple of months of the job and was then relieved, and I went off to the Far East. And I went as the secretary to the flag officer, second in command, which turned out to be a very interesting, varied appointment. I might just digress a bit from the job content there, say that I decided that I would take my family with me to Singapore as an unofficial family. I had to pay their fares. And I'd got a reduced degree of allowances for living out there. Now, I'd done this at the last minute when I was in the Cleopatra, and it had worked out most successfully, and the family had certainly enjoyed a much more varied and happy life, and even if I wasn't around myself a lot of time, that they had a much nicer time in Singapore and living in Johor Bahru than if they'd been stuck in England. And you know, financially one was at risk a bit, but not too badly. And in the end, it certainly, I reckon, it worked out to have been a profitable thing to have done. And when I was out there with FO2 in the Far East, I had been out there at least 3 months before I spent more than two nights at home. But I had spent quite a lot of two nights, because I was often flying in by helicopter for meetings in Singapore and that sort of thing. And it gave an opportunity to take my wife to Hong Kong. And so it was a worthwhile thing to do. And actually, you know, I found the job much less stressful, I think, as a result of being able to have my family there. But I was the only one on the staff to do that, apart from the Admiral, whose wife rather came and went. And if we were away for a while, then she would return to England. Anyway, the Admiral was a newly promoted Admiral called David Williams, who had just finished being the Captain of Dartmouth, and whom I had known as the Director of Plans when I was working for First Sea Lord. And he was a very good boss and has remained a good friend through to the present time. And I arrived after him, but because I hadn't been able to be got out of my previous job too quickly, and I joined in Singapore, and then we were in Hong Kong. We had umpteen moves of the staff. The staff of FO2 was, there were two commanders, Staff Officer Operations and the Secretary, and then there was a Staff Torpedo and Anti-Submarine Officer, TASO, a Staff Communications Officer, a Flag Lieutenant, and now all of those were Lieutenant Commanders, and an Assistant Secretary who was a Lieutenant. Actually, this Flag Lieutenant was a Lieutenant as well. And then we had a communications team, I suppose must have been about a dozen strong, mostly radio, but we did have a chief yeoman. And then we had a domestic staff of Chinese cooks and stewards who went around with us. And so we were a total team of 28. And we used to pack everything into huge, great wicker laundry baskets and move ourselves by lighter or Hercules aircraft or lorry from one ship to another, helicopter. You know, it was really a very flexible operation, and it was amazing how we could pack everything up in one ship and then be fully functional a few hours later in another. When, of course, many of the ships didn't really have proper, decent accommodation for us. But the our main flagships were the Intrepid, which did have room for us, and then Eagle. She came out, we joined her in Cape Town on her way out from England, and she was coming out to cover the withdrawal from the Far East in accordance with the Healy Defence Review, and we went to, in her to Singapore and then down to Australia and up to Hong Kong and did the withdrawal there, and then covered the withdrawal from the Gulf, which was possibly the most difficult militarily and politically. And then finally, by Christmas of 1971, we had completed the withdrawal, and we spent Christmas in HMS Triumph, which again had room for us, thank goodness, in Mombasa. And from there we then started to come on our way home. It was a very interesting job, particularly on the people angle. One was seeing so many different ships that were out there, were always operating with new ships, meeting new people. We had a large number of fleet visits to various places around Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and so on. And my assistant secretary was very largely the chap who organised all of those. There was a system, and he operated it. And it was a very successful arrangement, I think. And the outcome of the withdrawal from the Far East was we had done what we'd been told to do, and it was achieved. It became quite interesting when there was no shore-bound infrastructure anymore. There was no dockyard in Singapore, and we had to spend real money in order to get some repairs done and that sort of thing. And I used to just authorise it. I had no budget. We found ways of determining whether the expenditure was reasonable and whether the thing could be done quickly. There was a certain amount of trouble afterwards, but it didn't last long, and because all the money had been spent properly. But it was an aspect which had not been properly thought through by the planners in London, or in Singapore for that matter.
What were the specifics that needed to be done withdrawing from each of the places?
Well, most of the withdrawal was actually done by the Army and the Air Force, and we were providing a covering force in case anything went wrong. But the Navy, of course, was withdrawing from Singapore, and there was an arrangement was introduced, a new arrangement, ANZUC, Australia, New Zealand and UK, with Singapore and Malaysia as well as parties to it, to set up an ANZUC force based in Singapore. That took over took over mostly naval infrastructure. It was based up in the naval base. It didn't have the whole of the naval base, because much of that was then turned over to the Singaporeans. But there were buildings in the dockyard which were taken over by ANZUC, and of course I think now are probably being used by the Singaporeans. But it was a logistic problem, really, of getting everybody home, you know, and selling off what wasn't worth taking home. And I think there was probably a great benefit to the local economies from those sales, and no doubt those gifts that were made. I don't have enough knowledge of the detail of that. At the same time, there were quite a lot of disturbances within Singapore against Lee Kuan Yew. There had just been about 18 months before, the significant riots in KL between Malays and Chinese. So there were sensitivities there. But basically, it went very smoothly, and the places like the Jungle Warfare School in Malaya, you know, that was taken over by ANZUC, and arrangements were pretty much in place. It was more difficult, I think, in the Gulf, because having withdrawn from the Far East, we then took ourselves off the Arabian Peninsula. And the withdrawal of our forces from basically Bahrain, which was the main centre, I think the timing of that and the management of that was quite a significant challenge for the command of the British forces in the Gulf. But that was his business, and we were not involved. We were there to provide air cover and marine cover in case... because we had the Albion with the commando on board and the Eagle with her air group. They were our and then frigates and so on. Those were our principal forces.
Did you notice much change or development in the places that you were withdrawing from that you had visited previously in the last 10 or 15 years, socially or in attitudes towards the British sailors or the Britain as a whole?
I was certainly one on the infrastructure of places like Hong Kong and Singapore had developed hugely. A lot of building had gone on. Prosperity had come into both of those places in a way that in the early 50s one was not seeing. Singapore was always reasonably prosperous, but then it really burgeoned in the 60s. And likewise, Hong Kong. I think attitudes towards us didn't really seem to... seem to change. The people tolerated, they didn't like it if sailors or soldiers or whatever went on a bit of a drunken run ashore any more than the good folk of Leicester or something like it if it happens in this country. I don't think that there was any there was no antipathy that I found leaving behind. And then in later years I was in India, and there was quite a lot of nostalgia, not universal of course, for what the Raj had done and the way the Raj had done it and how it was much more effective and efficient than was the current mix that they were achieving. Shall we stop there? This was a very interesting time, really, to be in the Far East. My admiral, as the second in command of the Far East fleet, he reported to the fleet commander. But he was definitely the seagoer, and once we were away from Singapore, we had to make all of the arrangements and relate to the British and local government authorities wherever we went. And at the end of the time, the Admiral was the overall commander of all the forces east of Suez. There was in the Gulf I forget what his name was. He was a brigadier called Rowley Gibbs, who subsequently became the chief of the general staff, who was in Bahrain. But otherwise, the local command in the Far East, based in Singapore, gradually wound down, and we did leave behind the ANZUC, as it was called, Australia, New Zealand, UK, and that included Singapore and Malaya, the ANZUC regime, to have a continued partnership presence in the Far East. But that was really very small compared with what there had been before. Anyway, we went off to Hong Kong to start with from Singapore. We went up there in, I would think, the October of, the beginning of October of 1971, and closed down most of the fleet facilities, although of course HMS Tamar and the captain in charge, Hong Kong, remained there for some years yet to come. And we were having to maintain the efficiency of the fleet, so we were exercising at sea and so on, up there and back. And then we returned down to Singapore for a final steam pass, which was led by HMS Glamorgan with the Admiral's flag on board. Final steam passed off Singapore before we sailed off westwards towards the Arabian Peninsula, where we were to provide cover for the withdrawal. The worry being that we weren't sure whether it was all going to go peacefully. We were certainly very concerned about the position of Iran and those legendary little islands, the Tums and Abu Musa, in the middle of the entrance to the Gulf, were certainly going to be the subject of some dispute. And it was important to maintain a strong force, at least as a presence there, to try and deter, as indeed we achieved. And the whole of the withdrawal from the Gulf actually went very smoothly. The naval forces remained outside the Gulf itself, off Muscat and down to Mazira. And then we, although we did go to Bahrain by air just to deal with Brigadier Gibbs and to make sure that everything, we were all singing from the same hymn sheet, which we certainly were. And the Gulf withdrawal was completed in the early part of December. And we were then still in HMS Eagle as a whole staff. We had been in her for the previous few months. And we went down to Mombasa, where the Admiral and staff transferred into the Triumph, former carrier, which was now a maintenance ship, which was actually the maintenance base for the whole of the area, and the Triumph had been for 2 or 3 months there in Mombasa. Eagle herself, once we had transferred out, which we did by helicopter, Eagle went on down to South Africa for Christmas and then back home, while we stayed in Mombasa for in the Triumph for Christmas, and then sailed off for a cruise, you might say. It was certainly not of a great military purpose, it was much more diplomatic, towards returning home. We stopped at Port Elizabeth, which is an area where I had many family links, and as a result I achieved more square footage in the press than the ships did, which was somewhat galling for the Admiral. But we had a good visit there for nearly a week, and then we went across to Buenos Aires, which was a very fine city. We'd not known really what to expect there, but we had very good support from the British ambassador there. Was a fellow called Sir Michael Haddo, and he really had ensured that all the doors were opened to us. At that time, Perón was not in power, and the Argentinian economy was in some difficulty, and we had the bad luck to hit Buenos Aires in what was called a meatless week. They were trying to stop themselves eating all the meat which they would otherwise be exporting and earning foreign currency. However, we discovered that this wasn't too much of a problem, because the only meat which counted for the ban was beef. So we could have every other sort of meat. And many people had a really good time and getting out into the pampas, and we were very well looked after. During that trip, the Admiral and I went over to Montevideo, where one of our ships, one of the frigates, was visiting. And this was at that interesting time when the British ambassador, who was a man called Jackson, had been pinched, kidnapped by the Tupamaros, and he was still in his prison cellar, wherever that was. And so it was all pretty jumpy, and it was quite a brave move for the Foreign Office, really, to put an HM ship into Montevideo at this time. But it was a very successful visit from the ship's own point of view. The Admiral there threw a lunch party for all sorts of local dignitaries on board in this ship, which was the Minerva, I think. And I remember well, we'd worked out a seating plan, and I had a lot of trouble with the chief of police in making him sit where I wanted him to sit in accordance with the seating plan. Anyway, he did in the end. At the end of the meal, he said to me, "Young man, that is the first time in 30 years I have sat with my back to the door," which was really quite a surprising thing, not a factor that I had thought about at all. We went on then from Montevideo back to Buenos Aires and sailed on up to Rio de Janeiro, where we were having a very good visit until, sadly, a cook from the Triumph, Cook Carpenter, was murdered as an Ulster reprisal. And it's really rather an interesting situation there. We'd noticed in the English language papers, of which there are English language papers in all the capitals of South America, every day they had a banner headline saying another English atrocity in Ireland or something to that effect. And although nobody had given us any hostility for this at all, there was nevertheless on the local radio, they have English radio there too, amazingly, and in the local press, there was really quite a lot of anti-British feeling because of the Ulster problem. And poor Carpenter was suddenly a target of opportunity, I suppose, and some malefactor filled him with bullets, and as a result of that, we ended the visit to Buenos Aires early, and the ships sailed away. We of the staff actually were due to fly home to England, because as soon as the Triumph got into England, into Britain, we were due to embark in the good ship Blake, the cruiser Blake. And it was sad that after what had been a very successful trip, that it was soured by the murder of Carpenter. Anyway, we embarked in the Blake, having had about 10 days' leave, and then my admiral was relieved within a couple of weeks, and I finished that job. But running an independent squadron, and in fact not only a single squadron, but also responsibility for the other services, there were special problems in the Far East and the East Indies in operating without any bases. And the importance of the air supply and the Royal Fleet auxiliaries was very high, and the logistic planning was really the activity to which I gave most of my support, working of course with the staff officer operations. And another interesting thing was that we had submarines out there, but we were not a submarine operating authority, because that is a very professional business. So we supplemented the Admiral's staff with a submarine commanding officer who came onto the staff, and he was one who'd already done a suitable staff job before, and so we were temporarily able to become a submarine operating authority for that period. And throughout, we had very good support from Northwood. In those days, of course, communication was not like it is now. We had very good signals, but there was not the voice communication that one can have. And so, early in March in 1972, there I was, now completed that job, and I had several weeks' leave before I went to, with the same Admiral, Admiral Williams, I went with him as his secretary when he